Okay. Today we're talking with Howard Garvall, and Howard is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Child and Family Service. And Howard, you came on board here a little over 6 months ago, and at that time you mentioned some of the goals that you had sort of laid out, which included filling vacant positions, diversifying your revenue sources, and working on a new strategic plan. How is that progressing?
Yeah, well, Alan, it's we're moving along nicely. I started last April, and we are pleased to have filled a number of key positions. And I recently just hired our Director of Development and Communications, so who will be starting February 5th. So. We're getting there. We're really beginning to have the people on board that we need, but it's still there are still areas in, like all organizations in Hawaii, and be it government, be it nonprofit, be it business, everyone is still the first thing off of everyone's lips is how challenging it is to recruit people and recruit talent and keep people. And there's all this thing about, you know, companies are going to try to raise compensation so that they can, you know, try to not lose ground in terms of being competitive.
Right.
And nonprofits, you know, are facing a lot of the same pressures. And in some cases, we don't have those of us like Child and Family Service who are very government funded primarily. We don't have a lot of wiggle room, if you will, around how we manage our resources, and yet we want to do everything we can to recruit the best people to serve the people that we serve, so we can carry out our mission of strengthening families and fostering the healthy development of children. And also we want to retain them once we have them. So it continues to be a challenge, but we also know that there are other things that people are looking for in a workplace, and those the large percentage of our staff who come to an organization like ours are coming because of a need to give back and to feel like they're making a difference in the lives of other people, helping people change their lives and improve their lives. So if beyond compensation and our limitations there, we're focusing a lot on how do we create a workplace that people want to come to and want to stay at. And a lot of the other things that we know people find important to them in a workplace are things like good relationships with others. There's a collegial, you know, friendliness. There's a people enjoy, they like the people they work with, they enjoy working with those people, that there's a sense of respect, that there's good communication, there's good teamwork. And then the other thing that's very common is that there are opportunities to grow, to develop, to really improve one's skills and to enhance one's career through being in the organization. So even with our limited resources, we're putting a lot of attention on, one, creating the kind of workplace that people can feel good about being in, where people are respected, where people are treated well, where people are communicated with regularly, engaged regularly in the life of the organization, while at the same time focusing on, even if it has to be sometimes modest investments in how we develop people, how do we help them grow, how do we give them the tools to be effective in the jobs that they do. And we do put a lot of emphasis on training. Training is a key to quality in a lot of businesses, but in human services, if people don't have adequate training, they're not as, they may be great people, but they still may not be as effective as they could be without the training. So we want people who care and are committed and passionate about serving others, and that's a key dimension. And at the same time, there are skills we need to provide, help them to learn so that they can be as effective as possible with the families and people that we serve.
Now, you rely on volunteers and as to help your paid staff. What's the balance there between volunteers
we
and paid
have,
staff?
I don't know the latest exact numbers on volunteers this past fiscal year, but we have over 150 volunteers who, two of the key areas that we've had a lot of volunteers in are in our domestic violence program area and in our gerontology area. Those seem to be the two most frequent interests of volunteers, but we've had we have volunteers in our adoption service as well, and we've had other volunteers. So it's a great resource. I'm really intrigued by some of the latest thinking from there's an organization I know, Kelvin Takeda at the Hawaii Community Foundation is on the board of Civic Ventures out of San Francisco, I think it's based in San Francisco, that's really beginning to focus on the baby boomer generation and pointing out how that generation, if people think about retiring at what has been a traditional age, many of them, a high percentage of them, will have a good 20 years of healthy living left in them. And they aren't necessarily ready to just play golf all day. Either because they don't like golf or because that's not enough to fulfill them.
So that's a good recruiting area for volunteers.
So we think that is a hopeful sign that there are people that may actually help with future recruitment of volunteers. And for some people maybe that have been very successful in their careers, maybe haven't done something that's really has more of a social purpose, may at this point in their lives, I heard the guy from Civic Ventures, Mark Friedman, he has a new book out called he's calling it The Encore Career, which I thought is a nifty name. But that some of these people may even want to work in organizations that have a social purpose and do something different with their lives. Maybe they don't want to work full time, maybe they want the health insurance benefits, but that there's a sense that this whole baby boomer population may be a talent resource for both staff and volunteers for the future. So I think that's a promising trend, and I think we're going to see more of that.
Now you were mentioning the job market, and I guess there's more competition now. And you mentioned that you can't compete maybe with some other private for-profit organizations on salary and whatnot. Now,
specifically, more so in the in the administrative areas where our competition isn't necessarily other nonprofits only, but a lot of businesses, people in finance or in HR or whatever, those areas have typically been harder to recruit because it's hard to match the compensation, and it's often even a bigger gap. So you almost have to find that person that, really wants the kind of culture that a nonprofit organization has. That maybe they've done enough of the corporate HR stuff or finance stuff, and they're really interested in being part of an organization that's a little different or has a different social purpose more so in mind. And so you almost need to perhaps find someone of that ilk, if you will, who might be someone we could recruit, because on compensation alone, we may not be able to do it, especially in those areas.
Okay. And getting back to the volunteers, does that dynamic that you described really not come into play with volunteers, or are you facing, maybe previously where the job market wasn't as tight, you had volunteers who weren't really looking for work, but now that the salaries are being bid up a little bit, maybe that might pull some people who might otherwise have wanted to volunteer into the, workforce on the paid side, or is it?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't know that. That is a question. I just don't have a sense of that.
Okay.
I think a lot of people who are at a point in their lives where they're expressing an interest in volunteering are. That would not be an issue or a problem.
Okay. There was in the news recently, we talked about this earlier, a proposal by the Department of Education to lower the funding for special needs programs, I guess that would result in the pay for some of the providers being ratcheted down a bit.
Right.
That was earlier in the month. Is there any development on that, or is it?
Yeah, there is a development on that. The good news is that the Department of Ed did reconsider the rates for two of the contracts. One contract are the skills, these are autism services, skills trainers, and the other are the autism consultants. And those two contracts, they did revise the rates upward. And I have let the State Department of Ed know that we were pleased to see that they were responsive to the concerns of providers, because there was, as Beverly Creamer covered, there was the, I know, because I talked to her at the end of that session, there was a session at the Capitol with representatives from the Department of Ed, and Senator Suzanne Shun-Oaklin was kind enough to facilitate that meeting, and there were, Representative Gene Ward was there, Representative Tommy Waters was there, which we appreciated, as well as a whole group of parents of autistic children who were not invited to speak per se. It was primarily a meeting for providers, and the providers did not share notes about what they were going to say, but everyone was on the same page about concern about the rates as they had been proposed. So we have let Department of Ed know that we were pleased that they reconsidered the rates. Last Friday we got the information about the new rates for the contracts, and they've standardized, they wanted to standardize the rate to have one rate across all providers, and they have done that. And now providers have to decide, do we feel we can bid on the work at the rate that they're proposing? But we really were appreciative that they heard us, and they did respond with new rates. And they also extended the deadline for the actual responses to the RFPs for those two particular contracts. The Child and Family Service is the, as far as I know, is the only organization running two special schools for children with autism. And these are, as I understand it, the highest end, highest need kids in the spectrum of autism. And we continue to be concerned there because the rates were not changed, and they're lower than they were previously. And I did get confirmation on Monday, yesterday, that the rates are not going to be changed. That's been the answer from DOE, because I did ask for whether they were being considered or not, because we sent them documentation on our costs and everything with the special schools. So we are continuing to be concerned about the fact that the special schools rates have been lowered, and we're concerned about that. And it does not seem like there's a reconsideration that's in the cards here for those programs.
Now, just to sort of reiterate, they did reconsider the rates for the contracts you have dealing with autism services that you provide, but not with these schools?
Yeah, the skills trainers and the autism consultants, as I understand it, go into the schools and work with these children. We run two special schools.
Okay.
And we don't serve huge numbers a year. I think in the article, I'm not remembering the number we gave, but we're talking maybe 15 to 20 kids a year combined in the two programs. It's not large numbers, but these are the kids who have the highest need.
Okay.
And we are providing those two programs. And we have a school on our campus at our main office at Eva Beach, which we call Haole Nakeiki. And then we have a school in called Mahana. And that's actually in an office building, but it's on the fourth floor, and we have whole floor, very good space, I think, on the fourth floor, but it's not a school building. So those are our two programs that are the special schools.
Okay.
And we're still concerned about those.
Okay. Some of what we've discussed so far, people could get an idea of what Child and Family Service does.
Yeah.
But you know, there's state agencies and nonprofit agencies and maybe some for-profit agencies.
Yeah.
How does your organization sort of fit into the whole human services?
Yeah, we continue to have to help people understand that we are a private nonprofit organization. We are not a state agency, and people do confuse us at times, thinking we are, and we are not a state agency.
Because there is a state organization called Department of Children and Family Services, right?
Well, there's Department of Human Services.
Okay.
And there are other, within Department of Human Services, there's the Department of Child Welfare Services,
okay,
formerly Child Protection Services. So sometimes people may make that confusion. In other states,
okay,
they do call what is Department of Human Services Department of Children and Families or Child and Family Services. So it is a name used in governmental agencies, and that's something that we have to constantly explain and help people understand that we are not a government agency. We are a private nonprofit, and we always have been through our whole history. We were never a state agency.
Your history goes back quite a ways.
And we're the oldest human service nonprofit in Hawaii, so we were founded in 1899, and so we're over 100 years old. We're also, we've said that we're the largest human service nonprofit, and I believe that's still the case. There are healthcare nonprofits that may be larger, like I think Waianae Comprehensive Health Center may be larger than us now. But as far as human service programs, I believe we're still the largest, and we're on all the islands. We have services on all the islands. So that's one way to kind of, really be clear about who we are. And then the other way is to basically say that we primarily do services in three areas: prevention, early intervention, and treatment services. So we have prevention programs like Head Start. We're the Head Start provider on Kauai. We do Healthy Start, which is a child abuse prevention program. We do that on several islands. We have that. That's a key initiative of ours, and I believe strongly in Healthy Start as a model. And recently, there's a new program called Enhanced Healthy Start. So that's working with all the families we work with in that program are involved with child protection, child welfare services. So that's prevention. We also do programs that are where we call early intervention, where people aren't in serious trouble, but we're really trying to intervene. There's some signs of trouble. We're trying to intervene early enough in their lives to prevent more serious trouble. For example, we have our alternative high school called Haleoulu at our main campus, and those kids are having a little bit of trouble. They're not in serious trouble, but we're trying to be sure that we can intervene early enough, provide a good education, alternative education, and then help turn them around so they go on the right path. And then we also have treatment programs. So we have probably the most intense treatment program we have is a community-based residential program for girls. And these girls have had more serious behavioral psychiatric problems. And we do group homes for youth, boys and girls, who have had more serious behavioral health kinds of problems. So that's how we kind of describe what we do. And the other thing we say is we serve all ages of the life cycle. So, in Healthy Start, we're serving families of newborns, so really infants. And then we serve in our gerontology programs, we serve older adults, and we have quite a number who are, 85 and older. We're very comprehensive. We're not a single focused organization.
Across ages,
yeah,
and across,
yeah,
areas.
That's
of
right.
Service.
The kinds of intervention we do. Yeah.
Now, as far as budget and funding, about how much is your annual budget and how much of it comes from different sources?
Well, we started the year with an annual budget of somewhere in the $32 million range, but our in terms of our state contracts, we're probably closer to 30 or 28 or 29 right now. So we've closed some programs, so that's the reason for that. Our budget is I want to take a look at this past fiscal year and run the numbers, but we've been around 92% government funded, and that's a variety of federal and state and city funding. So, and we're fairly diverse when it comes to different funding sources within the government funding, but still, not about 92% of all of our funding is from government, which is quite high.
Because getting back to your sort of some of the goals that you set, one of them was diversifying revenues.
Right.
So would it be away from government funding or getting different sources within the government?
Yeah, I think we have a pretty diverse array of government funding, so it's really trying to increase our private revenue from private sources. So the combination of fundraising through private fundraising, and that's why I'm pleased to have hired a development director, but also the other area we're looking at is some of our services being generating more fees, earned income, earned revenue. For example, we're one of only two providers of employee assistance programs in Hawaii. We provide services to business and industry. We have over 40 contracts with different companies to provide counseling services to their employees. We also go in and do training in the workplace, things like violence prevention, substance abuse prevention, balancing work and family life, stress management, change management, and we also help supervisors who might be dealing with a troubled employee. And the value of those EAP contracts for business is that there's a lot of good data out there and research that shows that personal problems or substance abuse problems or mental health problems, family problems, have a major impact on the bottom line in terms of productivity, you know, absenteeism, and impact on the workplace, so that the modest investment that companies make in an EAP program can really pay dividends in improving productivity and preventing costs, actually, and even preventing costs on the healthcare side, because if people's emotional problems get worse and there's no intervention, it can start to have even more of a high cost on the health insurance side.
What does EAP stand for?
Employee Assistance Programs.
Okay, and
ours is called Hawaii. Our actual business, if you will, is called Hawaii Employee Assistance Services, HEAS, Hawaii Employee Assistance Services. So that's an area that we generate. Our income comes from contracts with companies and organizations, and that's something we would like to grow. And that would be an example of an area where we'd like to generate more fee revenue that's not public revenue.
Where you have an expertise, it sounds like.
Yeah, we do. It's a nice match because we, as a human service organization, we have the skill set to do the kind of counseling for people of all ages, and then we also have knowledge about some of the other kinds of issues that we provide training in, such as violence prevention and stress management and substance abuse prevention and so on. So using that competency, but also providing it in the workplace for a fee under contract with companies, they get the benefit that they're a good employer providing this benefit to their employees. Plus, the research shows it actually saves them money on lost productivity and absenteeism and so on. So it's an easy sell, I think, to companies.
Do you have a marketing person?
Yes, and that's something part of what we are in the process of doing is strengthening our overall marketing of that program. and improving our website and making it more interactive. And so it's really a matter of running a human service business, if you will, and increasing the marketing and having that kind of sophistication. But it meets a clear need for the employees and their families that we serve, the organizations and businesses that receive that service are benefiting, and their employees are benefiting. So it's a win-win all around, and we're getting to use our competencies in providing these kinds of services, and yet we're generating revenue that's helping us diversify our revenue base, you know, from just government.
Right. Now there's probably private organizations that provide similar services that you might be competing against.
There's one other competitor, and don't quote me on who it is. Yeah. There's another competitor in Hawaii, and then the other competition we face in EAP work are mainland companies that offer an EAP. What happens, though, sometimes with those companies is they offer primarily a telephone service and not an in-person service. They also don't know the local community like we know, because we're based here in Hawaii.
Right.
And so they don't have as good an understanding often of the culture and different things like that. So we think we have a competitive advantage in that we provide the service locally. People can go to any of the islands that we have offices on you know, in Maui. We have two offices on the Big Island, Kona and Hilo. We have offices in Kauai. We have a small operation on Molokai even, and of course Oahu. And so people can come to our different offices and get in-person help. Plus, they have people who understand, who are from this community and
right.
understand the local cultures and that kind of thing, whereas a mainland company would not necessarily have that, and they might not even offer an in-person service. And we believe strongly that the EAP really needs to be a face-to-face. And there are some things you can get over the phone, but there are, for people who really are more struggling more and are need some small short-term counseling, EAP can in-person sessions really is the way to go.
You know, you mentioned some of the unique things about Hawaii and having to understand the cultural differences and whatnot. Now, you spent a lot of your previous to this
sure.
career working on the East Coast.
That's right.
But in a similar field.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people in Hawaii, for whatever reason, because Hawaii is a little bit different than the continental U.S., are always comparing themselves, like, how are things here compared to the mainland?
Yes.
And when you got here and you started to see, you know, things like, you know, child abuse and sort of the challenges facing the educational system, did it seem like this, you know, sort of the same issues are in play here, or did you really have to rethink the way you looked at some of these things?
Yeah, it's been fascinating, Al. Actually, it was something that one of the reasons I was attracted to come was how there was enough that was really different about coming here and being at a stage of my life where I wanted to make a move, but also wanted something different too. This was a great fit. So it's been interesting to see how there are some things that are that kind of repeat themselves that I've seen elsewhere, and then there are some things that are quite different and seem more unique, you know, unique to Hawaii. And that's been really a great learning experience, and it's been kind of fascinating. What I have increasingly been struck by is the difference in terms of just the overall culture. And how I would characterize it is, you could feel it when I was at the opening of the legislature. You know, there was this sense of warmth and celebration and people going out, and food was a major part of that. You'd never see that at the opening of the legislature in Connecticut. And the lays, of course, on all of the legislators and them having opening their offices or having a reception for people, inviting the public. there was a much more open quality to that that was really refreshing. And then when you have the physical structure of the Capitol, which is open air,
right,
it sort of blends together. It's kind of a nice combination, if you will, that blended together. So I was kind of struck by that uniqueness that's really special, I think, and positive about Hawaii. While at the same time, there's some dynamics that are, I'm sure, exactly alike. You know, like, you know, it's still a legislative process. They're still positioning around people with certain degrees of power within the legislature, and you know, you get a new Senate president, and all of that stuff is obviously going on. And what's interesting is that Connecticut and Hawaii, which you would think are as far apart as you could get,
right,
have some parallels in that you have a female Republican governor with a very dominant Democratic legislature, and the governor has to govern moderately or even closer to being a liberal because of that dynamic.
Right.
But it's an interesting balance of power again, that the governor's office has been, now I know in Hawaii that's a more recent phenomenon.
Right.
In Connecticut, it's been going for quite a while that the Republicans have had control of the governor's office, but not the legislature. So a little different dynamic in that way, but certainly some similarities.
Right. I think, yeah, to be a successful Republican here, you have to make certain adjustments.
Absolutely. And Connecticut, like Hawaii, is a small state. It's you know, Hartford's the capital, and having been based in Hartford, my organization was based in Hartford, you could get there all the time, get there regularly. And Hawaii being also a small state, although you have the neighbor island dynamic, but it's also something where I think you can get there quickly, and you can begin to get to know the legislators fairly quickly. So there are some, a little bit of similarity in that respect.
Because versus larger states where you could be hundreds of miles from the capital and not really be there in front of the lawmakers.
Even in Massachusetts, which is a northeastern state, a lot like Connecticut, because I was there for 13 years before I went to Connecticut, you have Western Mass, which is physically anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours away from the Capitol on the State House. And so that you have this sort of dividing line in Massachusetts between the Boston, you know, and surrounding suburbs, towns of Boston versus Western Mass, which is like almost a whole other world. And yet it's one state, but the Western Mass side of the state probably feels less connected to what's happening in Boston, where the government is and the legislature is and so on. So
I lived in Virginia. I lived in Alexandria, and it was more tied to Washington D.C. politics and not so much to Richmond.
Absolutely,
it felt very northern. When you go to Richmond, it felt very southern. And
yeah,
it's very stark contrast.
I have a daughter who's in Lexington, Virginia. Talk about southern, southwest Virginia.
Washington and Lee University is there?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things we always ask, you know, people who work at nonprofits is, since you do work with volunteers and they're not paid, how do you approach them from a leadership or a management standpoint, and do they, and also from a motivational standpoint, as a leader of an organization, you've got to help keep morale up and keep people excited about their jobs. Is it different? Do you have to approach volunteers differently, or do they? How does that work?
Well, I mean, I think we have over 600 staff, paid staff, I think the great news about the probably the advantage that nonprofits have over any other sector, you know, if you look at government or you look at, you know, the for-profit or business sector, the real advantage we have is, and this is the way I tell it, I know that I get up every day go to work, and I know that I'm part of an organization that's doing good things for people, that's helping change people's lives, improve people's lives. And it's not that other businesses don't feel that or don't do that, or government doesn't do that or feel that, but in a nonprofit, you feel it really every day, and there are examples over and over. And it's core to who we are. It's our mission is who we are. So strengthening families and fostering the healthy development of children is really who we are. So whenever people start to feel a little bit down or discouraged, or you know funding isn't as good as it had been or whatever, and funding goes in ebbs and flows, and government funding especially. So like in Hawaii, when the Felix consent decree came in, and like in Connecticut, when there was a consent decree in one of the state agencies, all of these resources were funneled into that state agency, and then they were being put out to bid in contracts to providers. So many providers who got those contracts became larger, and then the consent decrees sometimes then go away, and then funding then may decrease. And so the same providers that grew with those contracts are beginning to consolidate and shrink a bit. So when there are those kinds of ebbs and flows in the life of a nonprofit, sometimes staff can feel a little bit discouraged. And what I always bring people back to is our mission and why people do the work they do. They, you know, and even the support staff, the people that are in administrative positions here, some of them are the best and most eloquent speakers about what it means to them to work around our mission. You know, one of our, for example, one of our staff, our facilities director, he's eloquent in his own way about what it means to be involved in this organization, even though he's about, you know, maintaining facilities. He's not about delivering services
right
directly to the people we serve, but he cares. It matters to him. And that's really powerful. I find that really powerful.
Is that, you know, you've been at this business for quite a while.
Yeah.
Was it something you always wanted to do, like right out of college or even before that?
Before, because when I was in high school, I was involved, I was in Newark, New Jersey, and we had down the street from the high school, we had a Young Men and Young Women's Hebrew Association, which kind of like the YMYWCAs, this was a Hebrew association. They're now Jewish community centers. That name went away years ago, and a lot of them are now Jewish community centers. But I got involved at the YWHA, the Young Men and Young Women Hebrew Association
in Newark,
New Jersey. And there were social clubs, and then all these different social clubs in the Y, they decided they needed a cabinet for the social clubs, and I became president of the cabinet of all those social clubs. But the more meaningful experience I had beyond that one was we had a Y Peace Corps, and these were, you know, high school kids involved in going out and doing essentially community service and working, going out and going to a camp for the mentally retarded children or physically handicapped children. And those were experiences when I was in high school that I gravitated towards. So I can trace back kind of being interested in more of a helping profession back to high school days.
Did anybody say, you're not going to make any money doing that, try and steer you into something more
lucrative? Well, I came from probably a working class Jewish family, and so they valued education, but money was not as big a driver. I'm the only one in my family who went to college, and so it was not as big a driver. So that's probably why I wasn't hearing the "you're not going to make
right
much money in human services" kind of message. We've wondered about that with our children, but my wife is a social worker, and in spite of us, both of our daughters seem to be gravitating in that direction. So they may not make a lot of money either in their lifetime.